Please support the Climate Change and Happiness podcast. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.
Welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, an international podcast that explores the personal side of climate change, your feelings, what the crisis means to you, and how to cope and thrive. And now, your hosts, Thomas Doherty and Panu Pikkala.
Well, hello, I'm Thomas Doherty.
And I am Panu Pikkala.
And welcome to Climate Change and Happiness. This is our podcast, a show for people around the world who are thinking and feeling deeply about climate change and happiness and what it means to be happy in the modern world. And that leads us in all directions, including relationship with nature and doing things in the outdoors and our mood and our health. And both Panu and I have a background doing different kinds of outdoor adventures. And we're really proud and lucky to have a guest with us today.
Hello, my name's Will White, and I am a mental health practitioner who primarily works in outdoor settings in New Hampshire in the United States.
Yeah, so I'm really glad to have Will here. Will is an old and dear friend and colleague. We don't get to see each other very often these days as we're separated by the length of the country, but Will and I met a long time ago in our earlier careers doing outdoor and wilderness and adventure therapy. And Will has a long and very kind of unique and illustrious career in founding outdoor programs and running these and helping the development of these programs in the U.S. And he's has a longstanding podcast himself that we'll recommend in our show notes. And he's also done a history of, at least in the United States, of this idea of outdoor therapy and wilderness therapy and what it's meant culturally here in the United States, which is really fascinating, which goes back a long time, and we'll touch on that a little bit. So yeah, we're a lot of directions today, but as I was saying earlier, even though we're in a technological connection here, my imagination is we're sitting around a campfire somewhere chatting about life, all of us from our various adventures. So feel free to join us around the fire for this episode, listeners. And Panu, do you want to get us started?
It's a great pleasure to meet you, Will. We haven't met before. I know that you have been very heavily involved in lots of outdoor activities, but has that been something which has been present for you ever since you were young, or how did it go with your relationship with the modern human world?
That's a great question, and thank you for having me on your show. Now, as I get older, I'm now in my 60s, I reflect back on, like, how did I even end up working in this outdoor setting? And, you know, I could say, well, I went to school and did this and that, the other. But I started looking back upon my childhood, and I grew up out in the suburbs of a city, and my father was a very hardworking, business person. And this was in Massachusetts, and his grandfather had a home in northern New Hampshire, and it's a farm, it's a tree farm, and my father would bring us all up there to do work on the farm and do different activities, and we'd spend our vacation. Many people would spend their vacations going to this place or that place, but we would always go up to this farm to work and, you know, also enjoy the hiking in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And it actually was the place where I saw my father the most happy. So he was not very happy in his life as a business person, but we'd go to this farm in the White Mountains and we'd be working on the property or hiking or fishing and all of that. And he was happy. And I think that was one of the big influences upon me to become someone who works in mental health in the outdoor settings. It wasn't as intentional as I thought. I think it was somewhat programmed and modeled to me of, like, if you're going to find happiness, like your podcast name, you know, climate change and happiness. Well, he changed our environment and he seemed happier. And that's how I ended up going to school in a mountainous town in Boulder, Colorado, and then coming back east and wanting to end up in the mountains, in the White Mountains of where that story began.
Yeah. And so you helped to found an outdoor program that still exists, Summit Achievement, which is a residential therapy treatment program for, I still believe, young people, adolescents. There's a couple levels to this question, and I'll see where it goes for you. But I mean, what was it like in, I guess that would be the 80s or the early or the 90s, creating this program? And what did people think about it? Now we have a lot more research about why nature is good for you and all this sort of stuff. But it was a little more innovative then. But then I think you also ended up studying just the history of people doing these kind of programs for, you know, hundreds of years in the U.S. So what was, what are some of your lessons from when you first started your own program, and then also how it was similar or different from, like, say, a program in the 1880s, 1890s?
That's a great question. Well, it was more serendipity in that co-founding Summit Achievement, in that I was a mental health practitioner working at a traditional boarding school. I ran an outdoor program for this school, and I was a therapist, because at any boarding school, you never have one job. You have to have two. You teach and you coach. And I was the counselor, and then I ran their outdoor program. And two people who had worked at Outward Bound in the last place that they helped run was on Hurricane Island in Maine, and they wanted to have full-time jobs working for Outward Bound at their level. They would work in the summer and then they'd be laid off for long periods of time. And they had some experience. They had worked at Vision Quest running a tall ships program up and down the East Coast, and they wanted to do an outdoor program. Initially, it was going to be hiking in the White Mountains and then going for like a month on a tall ship on the coast of Maine. And they invited me to be part of the process, because at that time, there weren't any licensed clinicians working in the space referred to as adventure or wilderness therapy. This is in the 90s. So they approached me and said, we want to do this. And I said, well, that's interesting. That sounds good. But neither of you are licensed clinicians. And so if we're going to do this, I want to be licensed as a residential treatment center in the state of Maine. And so we went to the state of Maine because we had our eyes on this property, and they said, we'll give you this license, but you have to make sure that the students come back on base and have so many days in the facility. And so we created a hybrid model. A lot of people see wilderness therapy as out in the field the whole time, but they were always at base on Sunday afternoon, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and they go out in the field on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. They come back, and they would meet with their therapist at the base and do family settings, etc. So at that time, it was very unusual to have a program like that, because it had a beds and had all that. We were highly influenced by Outward Bound, as I said, some of the former partners, founders. They were Outward Bound instructors. They really wanted to be a challenge by choice. It wasn't a program that took young people by transport. And it wanted to have a school component. I really encouraged the school component, because I felt what are we trying to do is help young people be able to be successful in school. So in that era, in the 90s, having a school in a quote-unquote wilderness or adventure program, all of that was quite different from even organizations that in the past, in that era, Thomas, that you worked at.
Yeah, so this is great. And I'll turn it over to Panu here in a second. But just to orient the listener, so if any of the listeners have actual experience in outdoor adventure therapy, they'll recognize some of the terms and things that Will's using. So the whole idea of whether the program is fully residential or whether the program is only in the outdoors, the idea of transporting people, you know, against their will, if a kid is in trouble and they have to go do a wilderness program, even when they don't want to, versus, you know, challenge by choice, which is the classic adventure therapy model where I choose if I want to, you know, do a challenging climb or some sort of adventure, I get to choose that adventure. And then the whole outward bound tradition, as Will knows, and Panu probably as well, but that program started during World War II in England, because the Navy was finding that its young sailors weren't tough enough to survive in the Merchant Marine during World War II, as the old sailors were much tougher. So they created these programs to sort of help young people to be more resilient in the outdoors to survive the rigors of war. And that turned into a kind of a recreational program that happened in the United States, especially in the 60s and 70s, that, you know, this whole back of the land adventure environmental is part of the environmental movement. And so by the 80s and 90s, there was this confluence of therapists and people trying to do this generation of people. And that's what, that's kind of where Will was getting started, and also myself. And, you know, and today it's really different. As I was talking about with Will, there's all different kinds of certifications. People do Japanese forest bathing, and in Finland, there's a whole idea, there's many different philosophies of nature, and we have all kinds of integrations of different kinds of therapy styles, like trauma therapy and things in nature. So it's yet another different kind of world now. And then, of course, climate change and environmental change has put a whole nother flavor on. We can't take nature for granted. That's how things have changed now. We can't just take nature for granted that there's going to be a White Mountains that we can just go to. The glaciers might not be there anymore. There's a huge existential shift that's happened. So yes, we, like I was joking, we don't like to go after deep questions here, but we can't help it, because, you know, this is big stuff. Panu, what are you thinking about over there as you hear us about some of the U.S. history, and what is it, where, how is this landing for you?
Yes, when I did research on emotions in environmental education, that was mainly because of complex, difficult emotions that people have in relation to the global ecological crisis and local environmental damage. But it was interesting that some of the earliest writings on fear and environmental education were actually related to adventure therapy and wilderness areas. So related either to fear in exercises like climbing, which may cause it, or then for some people, fear or anxiety related to being outdoors, especially if you are further away from cities and urban livelihoods than you have been before. So that sort of rises a general question for you, Will, that how do you see the role of emotions in what you do? I know this is a very broad question, but I'm interested both about emotions related to our relationship with the modern human world, but also these emotions related to environmental change and degradation.
I think it's all about our emotions and our connection with the outdoors. For me, going into the woods, and as I saw modeled from my father, he was happier and he was more relaxed, where I know other people who come up here and they're terrified because they are in the middle of nowhere, and there's bears and there's this and that. And I, going into a city, that environment is quite different. I get more anxious there. And I've been doing a lot of work now because of, really, there's a huge anxiety. There's much more diagnosis of anxiety in the world today than ever before. Now, we can see some of the factors you talk about on this podcast is climate change and our anxiety about that. And then our anxiety related to for many young people is social media, being connected electronically to social media and the smartphones and the random reinforcement it gives. So I think environment is so critical, and perspective on the environment and how we've all got to have we live in this era where we have to use electronics. But I really talk a lot about a healthy electronic diet. I love ice cream, but I can't eat it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that using electronic media is really, I think it should be used wisely. And I also think that being in the outdoors and can be challenging for people. But part of what Kurt Hahn, the founder of Outward Bound, talked about was, and it's even more prevalent today, is challenging ourselves to be out in the outdoors, because if we're challenged, we get stronger. We are able to see that we can climb something that we didn't think we could climb. And the idea, there's this whole movement called exposure therapy in anxiety treatment, that the more, especially post-pandemic, because there's a lot of young people who had became overwhelmed with anxiety, so they stopped going to school, and then their parents maybe accommodated that, and trying to encourage us, challenge us, and being the whole movement of Outward Bound and other outdoor programs was to make us recognize that we're stronger than we think we are, and that the idea of being in the outdoors, whether it's bad weather or good weather, it's about a perception in our minds. And we need to be cognizant of young people who maybe, you know, didn't grow up in that environment, and titrate their exposure so they're not overwhelmed. But I think our whole lives are about negotiating, and especially now, the changing climate. And mm-hmm. in some ways, we have to embrace it because we're in it. There's no choice. We're here. And we can do some things to mitigate those things. We can also embrace life as it is and the lessons that it teaches us. I have, as I said, a farm in New Hampshire, 250 acres. Now, for years, we had to log it. It was part of a tax to mitigate our tax impact. And now we're actually being paid not to log it because of the carbon credits, which is lovely. You know, that's, and I have to embrace that. And yet nature, with the climate change that happened, I'd love to have Thomas, has been there many years ago. I was walking the property last night, and I went deep into the woods, and there was this section that just a microburst came down and had devastated this whole section of old forest. It wasn't from our logging, because we haven't logged that section in a long time. And microbursts are these wind events that are happening more and more. And yet it was a lesson to me, like in life, microbursts happen, tragedy happens. The analogy of like whether it's a tragedy that happens in your family or a tragedy that happens in the world, we can grieve for that and we can connect to it, because that's what nature is teaching us. And as we get further away from nature, climate change is actually bringing us more into nature. There's a lot of foresters I know up where I live who have different political views than myself, and yet all of them, everyone agrees that climate change is happening. 15 years ago, no, people wouldn't. Now anybody who spends a lot of time in the woods knows it's happening and worries about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful imagery. You know, one of the underlying processes in a lot of this outdoor therapy, going back to the Outward Bound era, is the metaphors of when we see something in nature, it's a real thing, like the intense storm knocking down these older trees. It's a real action, physical reality, but it's also the social reality. We make a meaning out of it. We tell a story about it, and that story helps us to know ourselves, right? So it's like, I imagine, Will, that's the therapeutic metaphor. Like, so you're in this damaged forest, and so how does this remind you of parts of yourself that have been injured and damaged, and how parts of yourself has learned to grow and change? So I imagine you use a lot of metaphoric tools in your anxiety therapy work.
Yeah. It's really about the conscious use of a metaphor, right? How do we consciously use metaphor to relate to people of any age? Now, one of the great things that are happening in the mental health and outdoor segments is so many outpatient practitioners are integrating the outdoors, whether it's walk and talk therapy or forest bathing. And so, whereas it used to be you were in your office or you weren't in your office, and now it's more of a hybrid integration. And our world is changing greatly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the lessons that we're seeing is also, it's changing greatly, but not as fast as our minds are changing, because we spend a lot of times, many people spend inordinate amount of times on smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
And embracing social media and read instead of being part of the world as it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What are you thinking about, Panu?
Yes, thanks for all that sharing. And Finland is one of those corners of the world where the impacts of climate change are not as dire as in many other places, but still we are seeing them increasingly, and microbursts, for example, trombi is a name we use for that sometimes in Finnish, so they are getting more common, and so also for Finns who have a live connection to the outdoors, they notice many things that are happening. And in Finland we have a lot of general anxiety also, and depressive moods, and of course, as you hinted, Will, in the industrialized world in general, it's a growing phenomena. And some of the organizations I cooperate with, like the Finnish Mental Health Society, they of course do a lot of work in relation to these general issues, but they also have during the last years put on emphasis on eco-anxiety and various kinds of eco-emotions, both uplifting and difficult and in between. And that kind of discussion is very much still ongoing in research also, so related to how do some of the traditional ways like exposure therapy, how do they function in relation to eco-anxiety or distress, for example. And in this podcast also we've sometimes talked about ecological grief, which often includes many emotional tones, and how that can affect people's willingness to go outdoors. And it seems that there's a certain kind of exposure therapy element there that needs to be done. And mm-hmm. we don't have too many environmental psychologists or ecotherapists in Finland, but we have some, and they have also been arguing for this, that it's possible to get over those thresholds, mm-hmm. but then social support and having somebody to motivate you and listen to you is helpful. But how about you, Will, in your work and in people you encounter, how much do you encounter these kinds of difficult eco-emotions, or is it more like general anxiety and depressive moods and that sort of thing?
When we enter the conversation about ecological change, I always experience with that person being unsettled. I think it's a very common, we're unsettled by all of this, no matter who I'm talking to. I think in some ways, the older one is, the more unsettled, because you see it moving faster. Life is faster because you're older. And the change seems to be faster. And I think we all, as we're heading to a point, if you will, I'm in my late spring, early winter of my life. and I have young men, children, and I concern for them. I think about, so there is an unsettledness. And then I think part of my own experiences on doing expeditions and adventure activities, like, okay, I'm unsettled. What can I do? What do I need to do? And how can I work with this in my own mind? So how can we not cut trees? How can we lower our footprint? And that, as little as it may seem in the bigger picture, it helps my mind to feel like I am at least doing something. Of course, that's sort of a white man of privilege talking about, like, mm-hmm. my little steps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, I'm sort of like, oh, well, I do this. But that's how I work with my mind, because my mind can, it does, not unlike my father, who was pretty depressed much of the time unless he was in the woods. And that was really 2 weeks out of the year. Mm-hmm. The rest of the time is pretty miserable.
Yeah.
Till he retired. And then he spent most of the time in the house, and then he was the happiest I ever saw.
Yeah. Yeah, neat stuff. I mean, I think one of the benefits of outdoor work of any kind, whether it's gardening or managing a tree farm or something, is that it's concrete, mostly human scale activities. So it's walking, it's doing things with our hands, it's things that we're evolutionarily kind of equipped to understand. The 200 acres is big, but it's something that you can actually walk and get your head around and know a place. Even that itself is very therapeutic when we're living in the modern world of technology and abstractions, and trying to take in a whole planet. Being able to know a piece of land itself, people take that for granted, but that's very therapeutic. That's why your dad, one of the reasons why your dad thrived out there, because he could, whatever his work was much more complicated and abstract, I'm sure, than the tree farm. And then are these metaphors to follow up on the microburst, this kind of storm. We had a bad ice storm here in the Portland, Oregon area this winter. And it was one of these, they do happen from time to time, but it was one of these very climate changed kind of storms where it was much more extreme than typical. And everything was coated with heavy ice for many days. And many, many trees fell in the parks and in the neighborhoods, and trees fell in the city. Large trees fell on people's houses. People were killed. Some people were killed when a large tree fell on their car. And then they were electrocuted because of the electric wires. So it was a disaster. It wasn't just a storm. It was a disaster where people were killed. But it really brought home a lot of what's going on in the modern world. It isn't just the weather. It's actually very dangerous, extreme things. But even after walking in the parks with some of my clients, and, you know, we realized, okay, well, the forest endures, and a lot of the trees that fell were aged or infirm in some way. Their roots were compromised, or they were rotting on the inside. And so there is that natural metaphor of weak things get culled out of the environment. You know, the forest is ultimately healthier after these storms, you know. So there's all these metaphors about what survives and why. And the forest isn't dead in the microburst. I mean, that microburst area will, when you go there this spring, is going to be full of new growth and life and a whole different succession in the forest. Right, so life itself endures and keeps going in different cycles as a wisdom that we don't understand at all. So anyway, there's no end to the metaphors here. And it goes very deep in a sad, scary direction, but also in a really transcendent kind of maybe hopeful direction, or at least a direction that shows that there's always meaning. We've got a few minutes. Well, actually, no, we don't have a few minutes. It's 30 minutes. We're here at our end. Anything you want to leave us with, Will, in terms of what's come up with you in our brief conversation, or what you're taking away here into your day?
Well, I, just really in enjoyed this conversation. And my thing is that what I like about time in the woods is it brings us to the pace of nature and not the pace of technology.
Mm-hmm.
And we are organic beings, and we sprung. We were once in the spring, then we're in the summer, then we're in the fall, and then we're in winter. And that takes time. And slow your pace down, slow your mind down. Don't drive so fast.
Mm-hmm.
Pace of nature.
Mm-hmm. And
thank you so much for having me on your program.
Will, those are great. That's a great message for all of us and the listeners to think about the pace of nature. And, you know, Panu and I, and we all sorted out our time change glitches to get together today. That's another example of the social realities of the modern world. Panu, what are you taking away from the episode here, and how's your evening looking?
Warm thanks, Will. It's been a pleasure talking with you and strongly resonating with the pace of nature and the woods. And that's a constant effort also for myself to keep that element, and the Finnish pines luckily are helpful in that regard.
Yeah. Well, thank you both, and listeners, be well.
Take care.
The Climate Change and Happiness podcast is a self-funded volunteer effort. Please support us so we can keep bringing you messages of coping and thriving. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.